Teach Me to Code, episode 33. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. I know it's been a while, and I'm going to explain what's been going on, but in the meantime, I want to let you know that this episode, I'm going to play back an interview that I did with Corey Haynes last month. And then I want to also just acknowledge our sponsors. We have NewRelic.com. They're a monitoring application. They do a great job in collecting information about your application so you know where your trouble spots are, what's going slow, what's not, and where to make improvements. And then we also have Chargeify.com. And Chargeify gives you the possibility of managing your subscriptions and other financial transactions through your website. So go check them out at Chargeify.com. Now, as for what's been going on, what happened was from the 1st through about the 15th, I was there was a major push at work. I didn't have time to record anything. All I had time to do was code, eat, and sleep, so that's pretty much what I did. And after the two-week push, I worked about 160 hours in 2 weeks. It was just insane. And I went to the Ruby Web Conf and conference and spoke, so, and that was right in the middle of all of that, so... You know, I really just didn't have the time. And anyway, after that happened, about 2 days after that big push, I got laid off. So I've been looking for a job, and you know, been looking at several things, and I just didn't get around to recording. So I am doing that today, and we have a great interview today with Corey Haynes. One thing that I want to bring up regarding RubyConf, I actually bought a ticket to RubyConf. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to afford to actually get down there and stay in a hotel room. So what I'm looking for is I've actually set up a pledgy, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes. In fact, let me see if I can just pull that up right now so I can give you all a link to that. Okay, so if you go to pledgy.com/campaigns/13439, I'd really appreciate it if you could just donate like $5. That'll get me enough to cover the hotel, and it'll also get me enough to cover the airfare down there to New Orleans. Right now it's set to collect $1,000, but since I actually paid for my ticket, I'm not going to need $1,000, but I am going to need a few hundred to get down there and stay in a hotel. So any help you can offer, it would be super great, and I'll be tweeting all week, you know, thank you notes to the people who donate. So far I've had donations from Miles Forrest, and some of you might remember him from the interview I did with him. I also heard that he's taking over the Pragmatic podcast, so that'll be kind of fun, kind of cool to see. And then, Jason Carpentier, I'm not sure. Anyway, they each donated, and I really appreciate that. So if you could help me get down to RubyConf, I'd appreciate that. And, you know, I'm going to be sending information out in the newsletter, and I'm going to be putting out another screencast this evening. So look for those. And anyway, let's get on to the interview. Hey, everybody. This is Charles Max Wood with the Teach Me to Code podcast. And my guest today is Corey Haynes. Some of you may have heard of him. He is the software journeyman. He is pretty well known for the traveling that he did. People are also starting to notice the Code Retreat tour that he's doing right now. And he's also pretty well known for the Kata Casts, which, if I understand right, are recordings of people doing code katas and things like that. He's also a large proponent of the software craftsmanship movement. And so I'd just like to welcome Corey to the podcast and thank him for coming on.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Now, to start off, I mean, everybody who finds you online, I think the first thing they see is software journeyman. What exactly does that mean to you?
Well, the journeyman kind of title is sort of the next phase in your career after you've spent the first, I usually say, probably about 7 to 10 years, where you're just sort of learning basics. Learning how to develop software, you've got sort of that school of thought that you are becoming adept at and getting to the point where you can use the techniques you've learned to be productive and build reasonable software. After that, it's really a great thing to go out and learn from as many different people as you can and start incorporating other people's ideas that might not completely coincide with how you think software should be built. If they're being successful, but they're not doing it your way, then there's something there to learn because they're being successful. So the idea of traveling around, and it doesn't even have to be long distances, but just going around and programming with people and learning their techniques, also sharing what you've learned. So, you know, one of the things I'm really fortunate to be able to do is learn from one person and then pretty rapidly go and teach that to somebody else. And that solidifies the learning in my own mind. So I'm a big proponent of people going around and spending time with others and learning and teaching. And the journeyman mentality kind of captures that, I think.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I'm trying to think of the best way to formulate this. So journeyman is kind of the level above, I guess, an apprentice or a beginner. And how do you kind of gauge where you're at along that scale?
Well, for me, I think a lot of it is you gauge it by working with people.
Mm-hmm.
So the more people you work with, the better feel you get for your own level.
Right.
And oftentimes we hang out with the same sorts of people and we're all about at the same level. And we get this feeling like, wow, I'm great. I really know what I'm doing. And then you might go out and have the opportunity to work with somebody who has, you know, twice as much experience as you. And you realize that there's a whole nother level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that you can say, okay, when you pass this test or when you have this many years, you suddenly, you know, oh, you're a journeyman. Oh, wonderful. But it's that idea of really, I look at the apprenticeship phase as the point where you are studying a certain school and you're studying, you know, maybe you are, you have one or two people that you look up to and you read their books and you read their blogs and you look at their code and you study their code, see their techniques. And once you kind of have that internalized and it's able to be drawn on when you're under pressure, so when the deadline's looming and you have to get something done, the techniques you use in that moment are the techniques that are yours. Those are the ones that you honestly can say you know and understand and truly get. And once you have that, you can go out and start learning from other people and start incorporating that. So I don't think there's a concrete way to say it, but I think it's probably the first, you know, I like to say 7 to 10 years of your career.
All right. And you know, it's interesting because it seems like the people who kind of move into the senior roles or architectural roles are the people who have been doing things for at least that long.
Yeah.
And so I think the job market kind of bears that out as well.
Yeah, it's once you get there, you actually can start effectively teaching other people, and you've got enough experience. You've worked on a couple systems that have been long lived.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have anything that you've been really working on for, you know, 7 years or something. I know people who have maintained systems for a decade,
mm-hmm.
and that to me is a level that I don't have right now because I've never worked on one system for 10 years. And that's, once you have to do that, you gain an understanding into what it means to really truly develop a long-lived piece of software.
Right. That makes sense. Now, how does all of this, as far as experience and things like that, tie into software craftsmanship? I mean, software craftsmanship is something that I just recently was exposed to. It seems to have some overlap with Agile, but it's not the same thing. And, the focus is, it seems more on the quality of code rather than the, you know, how you got there, I guess. But, is there a certain level of software craftsmanship that come that shows through as you gain this experience, and how do you kind of figure that out?
Well, I kind of look the short little elevator pitch that I tell people about software craftsmanship is that while the agile methodologies and the agile principles were about developing quality software as a team, the software craftsmanship principles are about developing quality software developers.
Mm-hmm.
So we really go around and talk about practice and learning and ways to become better developers and better have a better understanding of what we do. And the agile, it's usually linked to like extreme programming techniques,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of that, because the more vocal proponents of the software craftsmanship stuff are, you know, a lot of us came out of the XP world, and so we had a solid foundation in these techniques, and we found both in our own experiences and the experiences of those that came before us and the ones that we've learned from, that this is a very effective way to develop quality software that can evolve over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing that was missing was really those techniques for how do you learn it effectively, and how do you, when you start doing, for example, test-driven development, it's difficult to learn how to do it, and you get these levels of understanding of it. So I usually say that when I started doing TDD, it was about 6 months in that I really got it and finally understood it. And then about a year later, I really understood it. And then another year went by and I finally understood it. And, you know, however many years now, it's been about 4.5 years that I've been doing that exclusively as my sort of development technique. Every year, I keep getting new insight into it, both from my own work and from the work of people that I've talked to and learned from. And so it takes a long time. It's sort of the move from, you know, when people went from procedural programming to object-oriented programming, it wasn't overnight. It wasn't a month that they suddenly were like, oh, I'm a great object-oriented programmer now. It takes years of understanding how to effectively put together abstractions in object-oriented systems. And now, as we see a resurgence in the functional programming family, it's going to take a long time before those of us who are coming into that world really understand the differences between how do you build abstractions in the functional programming languages and how do you build them in object-oriented programming languages. And even that with OO, the languages that we tend to use, you know, a lot of the people are using Java or C Sharp. These aren't really object-oriented programming languages. They're object-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have the full realm of abstraction capabilities that we do in some of the other languages and the old, you know, like in Smalltalk and some of the others, IO and stuff. And so software craftsmanship is really saying, hey, here's some techniques for more effectively learning what it is you're trying to learn.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I think it draws a lot on, you know, kind of where I've been going with my career. And I'm kind of on the ramping up end. I do try and help people, you know, learn or do better. But, you know, I'm still learning. I've been programming professionally for, you know, just 2 or 3 years. But, you know, it was interesting enough to me to think about, you know, oh, how do I become better? And then to come across a movement like this that's saying, well, you know, you need to be doing these kinds of things in order to build, you know, software better, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also to bring sort of a sense of professionalism into our industry where we're not looked upon as just some coders off in the corner, you know, with their headphones on. You know, we actually are a large community of people all learning from each other and
mm-hmm.
and teaching each other. Like, you know, your podcast is great from that of really focusing on while you're learning things, you're also sharing them and teaching others. And that you know, teaching is a great way to solidify what it is you've learned. And with the professionalism to bring in and say, if we truly believe that certain things are the way we should build software. So, for example, I absolutely, based on my experiences and the experiences of the people that I've learned under, believe that in an object-oriented system, certain techniques around test-driven development are highly effective and some of the best ways to develop software. So, you know, evolutionary design, more, you know, frequent releases, working code. These are things that we need to stand up and say, this is how software needs to be developed. We're professionals at it. We should be expected to you know, say no sometimes when we're asked to cut corners that are going to negatively affect the health of the system, which can then affect the health of the business around it. If you build unmaintainable software, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of money to change it as the business grows and as the business evolves. So we need to be willing to stand up as professionals and say, no, this is how it's done. You know, I'm paid and I'm hired because I supposedly know more than the people who hired and paid me. And, you know, one of the little, you know, kind of funny but not really necessarily absolutely true things is, you know, imagine if a manager went into an accounting department and said, you know, no more double entry bookkeeping. It takes too long. No more checking that you've added up the numbers correctly. That takes too long to do. We've got to get this done. I would hope that accountants would stand up and say, no, this is how you do it, so that the business doesn't suffer. Mm-hmm. And we need to do that more as software developers, but we can only do that once we've really internalized and can deliver on that promise of knowing what we're doing.
And that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's interesting because really when you think about it, the best businesses are made up of a group of experts, and the programmers are the experts on programming, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, they're the experts on software. You know, I mean, you have other people like marketing people and, you know, UI people and you know, and they're experts in their particular area. But, yeah, I mean, when it comes right down to it, you know, the software developers are the experts in developing software.
Yeah, and one of the important things in there is that word expert, which is you need to have an accurate sense of self-assessment. And if I say that this is how software should be developed, but I'm not truly adept at it, and I haven't really internalized it so that when the pressure's on, I do that, then we need to practice and we need to study and we need to be honest with ourselves about those areas that we're not experts in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not a embarrassment to say, I don't know how to do something. And so, for example, last year, I didn't know how to test JavaScript. I had never done it before other than writing my own assert equals and using that. I didn't know any of the frameworks that would allow me to do it very rapidly. And I was very vocal about it. I don't know how to do that. And then it got to the point where I started building an app that was a very heavy JavaScript application. And my sense of responsibility said that I should be delivering software that I can verify works. So I need to be able to test it. And I started learning how to test it effectively, not even worrying about doing test-driven development and having it influence the design, but just test it so that I can verify and at the click of a button say, yes, this works like it does, like it did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't break anything. So being able to do that and studying, taking the time necessary to practice. You know, one of the analogies I use is imagine if you went to see a band and the only time they ever actually played their instruments was when they were on stage performing for money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's unfathomable. People practice their craft. If you're a musician, you practice playing music. And we need to also do that as well and take time for ourselves to do focused practice that is not under the gun with the intent of producing software that goes into production. And so
that makes sense. Now, is that what the code retreats are about?
Yeah, the code retreats are a day of getting away from any pressure to complete so that you can truly focus on the fundamentals of software. So working on techniques that you believe in, but you're not, you might not be totally adept at, you know, TDD or even just the fundamentals, which one of the things that I focus on when I'm facilitating them is just the idea of abstractions and the ideas of not letting, you know, one of the common things is a string is a chunk of text. Mm-hmm. It's not a flag. It's not a phone number. Building abstractions is the fundamental task that we do as system designers. The great book, Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programs, they talk very early on about what makes a programming language and what makes sort of a design. And one of those fundamental things is how do you compose or how do you create abstractions in the language?
Mm-hmm.
And an understanding of that, which as I've traveled around and talked to people, is sorely missing in our field. We don't have this understanding of abstractions. We're not really taught it. We're not really focused on it. We're usually learning what's the latest framework, what's the latest, you know, API that we can use. And so what Code Retreat does is it takes the pressure to finish completely away. And by doing that, you suddenly start being able to focus more on, I used to say it's like doing scales. Mm-hmm. On a musical instrument, but somebody the other day mentioned that it's kind of like doing etudes, where it is you're building something, but you're building it and you have something that is a small constrained domain, so you can try things. You can, you know, put up a metronome and actually try to. Today I'm going to practice on going in time, playing my instrument in time. So at Code Retreat, one of the sessions you might say, this session I'm going to work on not, you know, I'm breaking my primitive obsession. So I'm going to start building abstractions for every concept in my system.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing where that takes you, the structure of Code Retreat is basically six sessions a day or six sessions on a Saturday, 45 minutes long. And at the end of the 45 minutes, we delete all the code that we wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So you can try things that you might not be comfortable with and things that you really shouldn't do in production when you're working on an app because you just aren't very adept at it. So if you try it and you fail, you don't have to live with it because on average, it's, 22 and a half minutes before you delete it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, through the course of the day, try new things, really see where it takes you.
Huh. That's really interesting. And, you know, I really like the idea. You know, it makes sense in a couple of different ways. I mean, for me, you know, yeah, I'm cranking out code for work and, you know, they want it done. I don't think I've been without a deadline for 6 months, you know, Yeah, I mean, so I'm trying to get this stuff done so that my boss is happy and so that, you know, so that the company can continue to make money and things like that. And so, yeah, I don't step too far outside my comfort zone just because, you know, I'm not willing to go in and clean it up because it takes too much time. And so that does have that appeal. The other thing that I like when I read up on the Code Retreats was that it seemed like you traded off who you were pairing with.
Yeah, you swap pairs every session.
Right.
And that also gives you a new influx of ideas. There's a guy named Arlo Belshi I believe he's in the Portland area still. And back in, I think it was 2005, he published a paper on promiscuous pairing where he had done actual like research and keeping numbers and all of that stuff to find out what's the most effective interval for swapping pairs on a high performing team. And what he found was actually 90 minutes.
Oh, really?
And they did all of these experiments. You can go look at the paper and some of the research that's gone on in the last 5 years about promiscuous pairing of knowledge transfer. One of the experiments they did was they, at the start of the day, seeded some small bit of knowledge, like a trick with the IDE or something like that. And they found that very rapidly that knowledge spread through the whole team.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that influenced a little bit with this swapping pairs every 45 minutes, because when you try something out with your pair, and if there's a jewel in there somewhere, you then go, the two of you spread out and share it. And it's kind of, you know, it starts building up. And by the end of the day, a lot of people have heard about that.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And really, that's the appeal, I think, to me, as far as pairing and switching with people regularly is, I mean, you'll pick up a lot of things that aren't really even related to, you know, the problem that you're trying to solve. And I've done that just with the people that I work with. You know, I'll wind up pairing with, you know, one of the other developers, and, you know, they may not have even been programming in Ruby or, you know, whatever we're doing as long as I have. And, you know, somewhere they along the line, they picked something up that is extremely useful. And,
yeah.
You know, and so I wind up, you know, incorporating that into the way that I approach building code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, and at the code retreat, we oftentimes will have people, the one in Orlando, we had people who were just very beginner, just starting development, and we also had Uncle Bob, we had Michael Feathers, we had Micah Martin, we had Brian Merrick,
mm-hmm.
A bunch of people who are very good and very experienced, so you end up getting a wonderful spread of knowledge there. So you had people who were, you know, only a few years in, mm-hmm. pairing with Uncle Bob, who's been programming longer than most of us have been alive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing to have available.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, what would it take for you to come out to Salt Lake City and do a code retreat?
Well, waiting until 2011, that's for sure. For me, I usually schedule them. I'm starting to schedule 2011. And for me personally, I try to either set it up next to a conference that I'm going to be at.
Uh-huh.
If I go to a conference, I almost always set up a code retreat around the conference. I've been, for the most part, self-funding my travels. I find a local person to do all of the organization because they know the area. Uh-huh. And I like to have it's a fairly inexpensive event, because the main cost, usually you can find a place that will donate the space.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, you know, buying coffee and bagels or something in the morning, and then a lunch. I like to have a nice, my one food constraint is no pizza, because I think that, you know, if you're going to come on a Saturday and spend the day, you know, spend 6 or 7 hours programming, and it's a really intense day, you should have a nice meal. So I always try to get a local restaurant to cater a good meal, a good, you know, hopefully it's warm, and usually take about an hour and a half for lunch so that people can recharge and talk. And so it's a pretty easy thing to do. And there's a lot of people. It's not just me doing the code retreats. There, mm-hmm. it stemmed. The first code retreat we did was in January of 2009, and so there's a lot of people out there who are actively doing them. We have them. They have them all over the place now. There's actually a couple people in Romania, Alex and Maria, who just do code retreats all the time. They're in. I think February I facilitated one of theirs, and it was number 8.
Huh.
And so they're crazy, and they do a really good job. And Alex has spent a lot of time thinking about the constraints around it. It's not just a day to get together and code. Mm-hmm. It's really focused on learning and focused on practicing the fundamentals. It's not really about learning new things. It's about learning better ways to do what you already do.
Right.
And so for the most part, contacting me is easy because it's just you can either go to coderetreat.com. On that site, there's also a page of how it works, so you can kind of see the format. And then I'm pretty easy to find on the internet, and you know, CoreyHaines.com has my email address and all of that stuff. But if not me, then there's some people. There's other people in the area who also, as they're going around, do it as well. I don't know if there's anybody who's done as many as I have, but that's just because I have a lot of freedom to travel around and do these things.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's another thing that I was a little bit interested in. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, they get involved in the community, but they kind of stay in one place. How is it that you have, you know, been able to travel as much as you have and, you know, and interact with as many people as you have?
Well, I guess when I first went on the road in December of 2008, it was, I like to say that I always thought about how great it would be to travel around, but I had two problems. I had a girlfriend and a job.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2008, both those things went away. And I actually ended up getting fired from my job. I was working at a little startup and it just wasn't working out for me, and decided, you know, I had some money saved up. And one thing led to another. By that time, I had about 4.5 years of socializing and networking in the Agile community, and specifically the XP community. So I knew some people. I was, you know, friends with David Chalamsky. I knew Uncle Bob. You know, knew a bunch of people, Brian Merrick, and these guys all out in kind of the Chicago area, and came out here to Chicago. I'm living in Chicago now. And then spent some time with them. It just sort of got rolling. I did these interviews. So everywhere I would go during the year of my initial travels, I did interviews with people and put videos up of conversations with people I met. So they, you know, there's lots of people out there who have great ideas but don't have a great outlet for sharing them. So I would set up my camera and ask them about their ideas. And one thing led to another, and it just turned into, you know, I ended up self-funding my initial year of traveling. So it was about, once I realized how much fun it was and how much I was getting and how much the people that I was visiting were getting, I just kept going. And the first year, I ended up spending about $20,000,
mm-hmm,
to support myself. And, you know, I was traveling around and staying on people's couches and guest beds and, you know, guest rooms and programming with them for a few days. And nowadays, I do contract work here and there. I do some trainings, just enough to make the money that I need to go travel somewhere else,
mm-hmm,
you know, and pay for the airline tickets and things. I'm, for the most part, settled in Chicago. I travel a few weeks. I'd say probably 3 weeks every 2 months I'm traveling and go meet people. And a lot of times it's for conferences and things. But for the most part, it's all self-funded.
That's really interesting. And yeah, I think that's, at least as far as like location dependence or independence, you know, that's a big thing. You know, I think most people you know, have a job that they're trying to keep and, you know, mm-hmm. have a family or, you know, have family or friends or whatever, you know, that they don't want to move away from. And, you know.
Yeah. And the thing is I, you know, I went to the extreme. And one of the things about going to the extreme of driving around, I mean, last summer I spent 3 months driving and I drove basically the entire East Coast from Miami to Prince Edward Island. And a lot of people can't do that. They've chosen mm-hmm. to put themselves in the positions for good and, you know, good and bad. You know, if you've chosen to have a family, awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's going to keep you from being able to just go on the road for 3 months. But there's a lot of people in your area. You know, there's co-working facilities. There's user groups in Michigan. And I think the Detroit area, they have this Code Slingers group that gets together every couple weeks, I think, maybe every week. And they all get together and they pair and they work on things. So you don't have to travel far to find people who are interested in programming with you. And you can, you know, take a day off of work and go somewhere else. Take mm-hmm. a day off, go to a co-working facility. You know, there's lots of independents who are working from home or working from coffee shops. Take a day off, go there and program with them. Learn what they know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and you know, there are a lot of talented people out here in the Utah area that yeah, I mean, you know, if I really thought about it, you know, yeah, there are people out here that I could pair with for a day that would, you know, that I would learn a lot from. I think they might learn a little from me, and you know, it would be a beneficial thing that way. So yeah, I mean, I do like the idea of being able to get out and, you know, learn what these people know without, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, if I leave the state, you know, I'm probably going to have to take my wife and kids with me to, you know, on vacation.
Yeah. And yeah, I had a friend who went to Disney World with his family and they were there for a few days and he, you know, talked it through with his wife and ended up taking a day. And while his wife was with the kids at Disney World, he drove up to Jacksonville Beach and spent the day at Hash Rocket, pairing with them. And, you know, so he had traveled there, but then he took a little bit of time for himself to do some training.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's people everywhere. One of the core statements in the Software Craftsmanship Manifesto is this, you know, community of professionals. And that community is both the large overriding community of everybody who develops software, not just programmers, but testers and analysts and all of these people. But there's also that micro community that is often surprising when you go somewhere and find that, you know, there's a handful of people just hanging out programming together when they can.
Mm-hmm.
And I doubt that there's many places where somebody couldn't find a group of people willing to share, start a small group, maybe a book club, get together, work on, you know, just hack nights,
mm-hmm.
or even a small product. If you have people who are interested in different areas of software development, other than just the programming aspect, you know, have them, you know, sit down and talk about it. Working with a very solid, experienced QA person is a eye-opening experience. And find companies. If you're in the North Carolina area, there's a couple companies. There's companies all over that are that have like Friday open studio day.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go in. You could take a Friday off. In Chicago, there's a couple of them. And there's Optiva and Eighth Light and you know, there's Relevance down in North Carolina. There's a couple places in, you know, all over the place. And you can contact somebody there and say, yeah, I'm interested in coming in for a day. And they'll say, oh, Fridays are open studio. You know, we work on other things. Relevance has open source Friday. So every Friday, their developers work on open source.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do any client work on Fridays. And anybody that, you know, if you contact them, you can go in on a Friday and and work with them. Work on open source with people who are very good. So it's there's always people around.
Yeah, and it's true. And, the you know, like we kind of talked about before, I mean, you know, no matter who you're working with or talking to, you know, you have the opportunities to, you know, to work with people, even if they don't seem as experienced as you are, you know, to pick things up. And, you know, all you have to do is reach out. I mean, I think most major metropolitan areas have both companies that are doing things in whatever technology you're working in, and you know, they also have users groups where you can get together and find people who want to do what you're interested in. And it, you know, it's really interesting in this area. I've been going to the users groups meetings for probably 2 or 3 years, and you know, people decided that they were interested in JavaScript, so they started up a JavaScript group off of the Ruby group. And yep. There's another group that just started a Hadoop group, you know, off of the Ruby group, you know, because there were enough people who were interested. And, you know, I was talking to a guy who's one of the organizers of the Hadoop group. And, you know, they're not talking necessarily about how it works or what it does. You know, the whole purpose of the group is to challenge the way that they think about the tool and find new ways of extending its use. And, you know, it seems like that's a lot of the same mentality that you know, you have about just software in general, is, you know, yeah, to find ways to challenge what you know, or to, you know, to try things and not be afraid to fail, because when you fail, what you figured out is either I need to learn more about this, or there's a wall there that I can't, you know, get over.
Yeah, and, you know, finding things in Chicago, there's a thriving community, and you can pretty much get a group of people willing to talk about anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, there's the NoSQL Summer going on right now, where all over the world there are, you know, reading clubs and, you know, papers every week, or I don't know if it's every week or every month. You download a new paper and you discuss that paper. And it's a great, you know, there's these sorts of things where you can grab it and you don't have to come up with a new idea of what to talk about. And that's nosqlsummer.org is the main site for that. And they say, okay, we're going to talk about this paper. And it's to really become a better software developer, it isn't about learning the latest API or the latest framework, although that's important for your day job, the mm-hmm. stuff you do when you're coding for food. But understanding the fundamentals is that meat and talk about what's the fundamental difference in your design and your development when you do MapReduce, as opposed to writing procedural code mm-hmm. or writing object-oriented code. You know, I just built a small little component for our system that has quite a few decision points and quite a few conditional things, and I didn't use a single if statement because I used instead more of a map select reduce kind of idea, and just took collections and filtered them and then reduced them where I needed to, mapped them into other things. And I was able to build, you know, a fairly complicated decision tree without writing, you know, heavy procedural code with a lot of if statements.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not because I'm a great developer. It's because I've read and looked at these sorts of concepts. What, you know, how do you effectively use a MapReduce paradigm when you're building stuff, and knowing when to apply it, and when do you apply, you know, heavy object-oriented principles, and when do you apply strict procedural principles, and that's really the fundamentals of software development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the direction that I wanted to take Teach Me to Code, and basically what I came down to was, you know, I've come up with a little tagline that is, you know, writing the code is the easy part. And, mm-hmm. you know, effectively what that boils down to is, you know, putting characters on the screen that tell the computer how to do something, that part is easy. I mean, you just have to, you know, understand the language. It's like using a tool. If you understand a screwdriver, then, you know, you can put the screw in. But the real trick is putting the screw in the right place, you know, yeah. or you know, maybe a screw isn't the right answer. Maybe you need a nail, you know, and so it's the thought process. It's the fundamental understanding of, you know, I have this problem and there are all of these solutions to it. And, you know, I think understanding what solutions you have comes with experience, but then being able to think through the solutions that you have available to you and determining which one is the one that makes the most sense, you know, and then thinking through, okay, now how do I translate the concepts of whatever design pattern I came up with or, you know, whatever algorithm I've determined that I'm going to use, and basically boiling that down so that I can put characters on the screen to write it.
Yeah.
You know, the hard part's the thinking, the easy part is the typing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But I will say, I have a sticker on my laptop that says typing is not the bottleneck. And the one thing that's important, I recently, about a month ago, kind of put out this idea of Learn to Type Week.
Mm-hmm.
And put out some resources for people to learn to type, because there's, you know, there's a surprising number of developer, a frightening number of developers out there who don't really kind of home row touch type, and it's either hunt or peck, or maybe their hands are flying all over, but you see that, like, their heads bob down, you kind of look at the keyboard, maybe you're not as adept with the numbers or being able to hit the symbols that well. And it's important to know those fundamental skills as well. So we do, you know, the typing's not really the entirely the only thing that's important, but you can be much more effective if you don't have to think about some of these fundamental skills.
Mm-hmm.
But again, from a large scale system perspective, the actual writing of the code isn't that important. And, you know, learning other languages that are going to influence. When I was, I spent about seven years actively doing C#.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was along the side learning, I was learning Ruby. I was learning some other things. I spent a period of time really getting into the fundamentals of JavaScript and, like, prototype inheritance and doing sort of interface and behavior-based development versus very heavy state-based. It started to influence my C#. The C# I was writing, even though I wasn't writing in those languages, it still brought over, and I started doing different things. I had a better understanding of, you know, I had a better understanding of interfaces and roles and responsibilities from working in a language that didn't even have those. And so everything was about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting too, you know. I mean, you know, you get used to doing things in one way, and then you kind of pick things up, and, you know, I really like the idea, you know, and this is probably a little off of what you just said, but, you know, the idea of while you're adept at Ruby, you're adept at C#, you know, going and challenging the world in a different way, you know, with Ruby and things like that.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been, you know, really heavy into JavaScript and using some of those techniques. And just today I was pairing with a guy and was just like, man, Ruby just makes me sad, because I needed a good way to do a closure, and I just didn't have it in Ruby. And then he figured out a way to do what I needed to do a little bit differently. But it started, you know, all of these other ideas and these other techniques start influencing your core, you know, your daily language, the one that you use to, you know, put food on the table.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we're just about out of time, and I do really appreciate you coming onto the show. I want to encourage our listeners to go to coderetreats.com and see where you're going to be traveling to, and what you're going to be offering, and you know, if you want to follow Corey or contact him, he's on Twitter at Corey Haynes, that's CoreyHaines. You can also just go to CoreyHaines.com, and all of his contact information is there. Is there a way that you prefer people reach out to you, or?
Email's usually the best. Pretty much everywhere in the world you can contact me by Corey Haynes. Email's the best. I reply to most everything I get. There'll be people out there who say that I didn't reply to them, but I try to reply to people. I'm trying to get a better handle on the stuff that I've, the emails that people send that I'm trying to respond to. And a lot of times I like to hook people up together and say, I know somebody in your city who's also interested in this.
Uh-huh.
And the Code Retreats are really important. We're doing one, the Software Craftsmanship North America Conference is in Chicago in October. And we're doing a code retreat the day after that. We're doing one. Almost all of the ones that are left now for me are international. But in 2011, we have more coming. If you just look out there, there's a lot of people who have written blogs about them.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. And, yeah, I mentioned real briefly the Codacast site, which is codacast.org, I think. And it's a... I have a description of what they are and everything, but it's sort of the idea of performance katas, which Micah Martin brought into a collective understanding of them. Those are interesting to watch. It's interesting to see other people code.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate you taking the time. I know we shifted the schedule around a little bit, so I'm glad we finally got on the same schedule.
Yeah, well, you're busy, and I'll admit to having gone to Disneyland last week, and it's been kind of crazy, but it's for me, it's not just hey, I get to talk to these cool people, but I mean every guest that I've had on the podcast, I've learned something from, and I pick up these things, and some of them are related to how I code and things like that. But a lot of them are just, hey, well, think about doing things this way, or, go check this out or that out. And you've really, I think, provided a lot of things that people can kind of go and look at and say, okay, now how does this apply to me? Especially relating to software craftsmanship and just the way that they learn to code. So I really appreciate the insight, and hopefully we can do this again, maybe in a few months and kind of see where things are at and give people some more ideas of just, what they can do and what they can pick up.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it, and keep it up. I've been, catching up on your podcast over the last couple months. I think I came across it probably about 4 months ago. And so I've been downloading them and listening to them on my commute, and keep up the good work you're doing. I like the interviews are really great, and the sort of every other week where you're talking more about sort of soliloquy style about things. They're mm-hmm. Great stuff. So, one last thing I wanted to mention: we're bringing back the XP Universe Conference next year, which is it's going to be a hands-on technical conference focused on the extreme programming techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Probably be in September. You can go out and it's the XP Universe 2011 on Twitter, and we're just starting to come up with the preparations, but it's going to be a great conference, small, focused on really kind of hands-on stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think it's going to be held?
Cool. We are looking at some of the cities we had, between maybe Chicago, maybe St. Louis, maybe Salt Lake, maybe Minneapolis. There's a lot of, probably somewhere central in the continent, so people can get there pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be in probably late September. And
Well, cool. I like Salt Lake, but maybe we'll find a way to go either way.
Yeah. Well, in any case, thanks again.
Yeah, no problem.
Keep up the good work with this.
All right. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. That was a great interview with Corey, and I just want to thank him again for coming onto the podcast. Before we go, I want to remind you to go check out our sponsors, NewRelic.com, great monitoring software, and Chargeify.com to help you with all of your financial needs on your podcast or on your website. And then finally, I want to remind you that I am trying to get to RubyConf, so any help you can give in that regard would be greatly appreciated. And, just go to pledgy.com/campaigns/13439. Thanks.